This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The nomination of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court has led to a wave of articles about black neoconservatives. One of the names that is always included is Shelby Steele. He's the author of the controversial bestseller, The Content of Our Character, A New Vision of Race in America. It was first published last year and won a National Book Critics Circle Award. It just came out in paperback. In the introduction to the book, Steele acknowledges how difficult it is for blacks and whites to discuss race with each other. The things you say publicly are sometimes different from your uncensored thoughts and feelings. This book was Steele's attempt to end his own public-private racial split. The book takes the position that racism is still a barrier to black progress in America, but it's not as formidable a barrier as it once was. Steele says too many blacks put too much blame for their problems on society. There's a price they pay for this emphasis on their own victimization.
When you actually evolve an identity that's grounded in victimization, I think the effect of that is that you then grant power to change your life to the very people that you are saying victimized you in the first place. You make society, you make whites more powerful than yourself when you, again, adopt victimization as an identity.
Now, you also write that one of the greatest problems black Americans currently face, one of the greatest barriers to development in society, is that the black memory of oppression has such power, magnitude, depth, and nuance that it constantly drains the best resources into more defense than is strictly necessary. Can I get you to elaborate on that, on how you think that oppression is draining off energy that should be channeled into other things?
Well, I think this is something that happens to any group that has been oppressed. When you begin to come out into greater freedom in society, the memory of oppression can, in effect, make you feel that that you are as oppressed now as you used to be, and so you can get a bit distorted there, and exaggerate the degree of your oppression, and so then in that case, then you're defending yourself against a degree of oppression that is not real.
So do you think that the oppression of blacks in America has decreased recently?
Yes, I do. I think there's no doubt about it, which is not to say, again, that there isn't some racism left in society, some discrimination that we obviously have to continue to be vigilant about. But clearly, looking at my own life, I can certainly see dramatic changes from the time I was a child going to segregated schools and the situation that I live in today, that my children live in.
But you say that you think a lot of blacks are reluctant to lose the status as a victim, even though there is less racism in society now than there used to be.
Yes, because I think that victimization, our history of victimization, has ironically given us the greatest power we've ever wielded in American society. It's the moral power that came from victimization that enabled us to win the victories of the Civil Rights era and to gain redress from society. And so since that has been our power source, we've been reluctant to move on and develop other power sources. And I think what we've in fact done is revolve our entire identity around that victimization, so that the poor black is the true black. The higher you climb in society, then the more marginal you become. You're an Oreo. You're a sellout. Colin Powell's blackness I hear questioned a good deal, but I never hear the blackness of a crack dealer in Harlem questioned. So we have again, victimization is what authenticates the black identity today.
Well, you write, as a middle-class black, that you've often found yourself contriving to be black. What's an example of that?
Well, again, that goes back to this victim-focused identity that has emerged over the last 25 years. So that if you are the only way that... And people, of course, accuse Shelby Steele of not being black all the time. So if I want to prove that I am black, the first thing I have to do is point to some instance in my life where I was victimized. I have to say, well, I went to segregated schools. I grew up in an all-black segregated community, and that appeases people. Say, well, okay, then maybe he is black, or maybe he used to be black. In other words, black becomes equated with victimization. And so when I say contriving to be black, what I've got to do is again, claim a degree of victimization in my life that may or may not be there, but in order to authenticate myself as being black, then I've got to somehow point to victimization.
As you write in your book, you're middle class, you're a college professor, you live in a white suburb, your children go to schools where they're the only blacks in their classes, and your wife is white. How do you think that's affected your credibility among different groups of blacks and whites? Do you think that is something that affects your credibility in the eyes of some of your critics?
Well, I have no doubt that it does. Again, on the other hand, I remain black, no matter where I live, no matter who I'm married to, and so my experience is a black one. And my point in the book is that there are millions of other blacks like me. All blacks do not live in the ghetto, only with other black people. The black race is a very various race, and our experience is various and different. And so my experience, my point, what makes me black is not my victimization. It's not even my proximity to one race or another. It is simply the fact that I'm black.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Shelby Steele, who's author of the bestseller, The Content of Our Character, A New Vision of Race in America. It just came out in paperback, and Steele is a professor of English at San Jose State University. You think that affirmative action has actually done more harm than good in the United States. Why do you think that?
Well, again, it's a phrase where it qualifies more harm than good. I don't say affirmative action never helped anybody. I just think that we've come to a point where by affirmative action, I'm talking about the use of racial preferences, whereby standards are actually lowered so that minorities or one group or another can gain admission to a workplace, to universities, and so forth. When you do lower the standard in order to prefer a given group, you inevitably stigmatize that group with inferiority, which is precisely the stigma that blacks have fought 250 years to try to get out from under. So in a sense, affirmative action allows the society to reenact racism.
Let me get to what some of your critics have had to say about your book, The Content of Our Character. Now, Stephen Carter, who's a Yale law professor and author of the new book, Confessions of an Affirmative Action Baby, has this to say. Steele suggests that racism is receding, and he's partly correct. It's no longer the all-encompassing force it once was. What Steele misses is that racism, in its many modern varieties, continues to operate with awesome force in the lives of many of the worst-off members of our community.
I disagree with him. I think that what's operating in the lives of the worst-off members of our community is the chronic cycle of poverty and all of the disorientation and despair that goes along with that. I don't think racism per se is the problem of teenage welfare mothers. I mean, they're not in a situation where they're interacting enough with the mainstream to be the victims of racism. They're the victims of possibly the legacy of historic racism. Certainly they're the victims of that. But today they're now victims of these deeply entrenched patterns of poverty that you can see in any poor community.
Well, let me continue with what Stephen Carter writes. He says, although racist depression might no longer be an important barrier, what might be described as racist indifference still rears its ugly head. And he says, even if, as Steele suggests, there are few effective barriers to advancement for the talented, there may be barriers to the acquisition of talent, and the barriers increasingly run along class lines.
Well, then he ought to really blame it on class, because then that's the problem. And I think that is a serious problem. But poor people of any race do not have the same opportunities to develop their talents as middle class people do. But he's, I think, blurring the race and class and poverty and everything else and subsuming it under the category of race. And I think he ought to be more careful in his distinctions.
Let me share one of my reservations. You raise really interesting points about the position, especially of middle-class Black Americans who haven't faced the degree of racism and oppression of the past, and who also aren't necessarily Black in the stereotypes that even some Black people hold about what being Black means. But it seems to me you've kind of elevated this to an ideology, and you've made it seem that if Blacks stop identifying as oppressed and stop blaming mainstream culture for their oppression, that poof, they'll just succeed. All obstacles will be gone, and if they just apply themselves, success awaits. I mean, wouldn't you agree that there really are just a lot of other obstacles that are kind of inherent within the social and economic system now?
Absolutely. I'd never say otherwise. I think, frankly, that it's tougher for Blacks. And I think racism is one of the reasons it's tougher for Blacks today. But it's a cruel and it's an unjust fate. I think people look for fairness where fairness is impossible. The point is, we're still suffering from the fate of slavery and so forth. But what is the answer? To give up? To take our ball and go home? I think that our only chance is to even though it may be tougher, is to continue to fight, to use initiative, and to help ourselves. Because obviously, the history of America indicates that there's not a great deal of willingness or even capacity in the part of the larger society to really help us.
Shelby Steele is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Shelby Steele, and he's the author of the controversial book, The Content of Our Character, A New Vision of Race in America. It's a bestseller that just came out in paperback. He's also a professor at the San Jose State University. You write that you were caught up in the Black Power movement in the 1960s. What changed your point of view about Black Power? Why were you a part of it, and what later alienated you from it?
Well, I was a part of it because for the reasons probably that many people were. I was very angry, and you don't really feel your anger until you begin to sort of sniff freedom and get a bit of freedom, and then you realize what you did endure. And again, in the mid-60s, after the civil rights legislation and so forth, and there was a greater degree of freedom, that was really the first time that I certainly, on a visceral level, began to experience the anger at what had been done to me and to other Black people. And I think that the Black Power movement that began to come about at that point in time was in many ways, among other things, an expression of that anger. And I think it was a very necessary and absolutely inevitable process. There's no way to come out of a situation like that without a lot of anger that has to be dispelled. And I think a lot of that anger is still around today.
So what changed your mind about the Black Power?
Well, I began to realize that its function really was anger, the dissipation of anger. And as time went on in the early 70s, it became clear to me that I was going to have to live down here on the ground in American society like other people, that I'd have to get a job and raise a family and buy a house and pay a car note, and that Black Power wasn't going to do that for me. That I would have to find ways to do that in society on my own. And so you simply grow up and you understand that you can't linger in that anger, that regardless of what's happened, it became clear to me that the best way to move forward was to become a part of the mainstream.
Stephen Carter has a new book called Reflections of an Affirmative Action Baby, and he writes about how he knows he's been the beneficiary of the benefits of affirmative action, yet he's very ambivalent about affirmative action. And I wonder if you feel the same way, if you've ever felt like you were the beneficiary of any of that, even though you're very critical of it.
Well, I came along just before there was a lot of affirmative action, certainly in terms of college admissions and that kind of thing. I was still sort of the era where I met some more resistance than preference. And I can't really look to too many instances in my own career where I think that's had much of an effect. You know, I think it's a little indulgent to worry too much about whether you have you've benefited or not. Again, I think if you have, then fine. I think the important thing is to move forward. And in any case, whether you've benefited or not, that's really not a justification of the policy.
As we speak now, the Senate Judiciary Committee is in the middle of confirmation hearings on Clarence Thomas. What's your take on him?
I admire Clarence Thomas enormously, and again, he represents certainly many of the values that that I've talked about. Here's somebody who, and people say, well, his life story, his rags to riches story, should not be an element in whether he sits in the court or not, and I pretty much agree with that. On the other hand, I think it does say a great deal about the man's character. And certainly as a role model for blacks, I think he has much to offer. Again, he indicates, as I try to do in my book, how it is actually done, how one actually does move forward in this society. And one of the legacies of our 250 years of oppression is that when we came out of it in the 60s, we didn't know very much about how it was done, about what buttons to push and so forth and to move forward in American life. In slavery, all the values of initiative and self-reliance were conditioned away from blacks. In 1938, a black was lynched for painting his house. Well, you can hardly develop the attitudes and values that it takes to thrive in freedom under those kinds of circumstances. That's the challenge that faces us today, precisely the challenge. And Clarence Thomas, I feel, is a superb role model in that regard.
Well, you want a Supreme Court justice to be more than a positive role model. What do you think you know of his legal record?
Well, of his legal record, again, I certainly am not a constitutional scholar or anything, but what I have read of his decisions, for example, his criticism of Brown versus Board of Education, which I thought was an interesting criticism, and other things, I found fascinating and original. I have talked to him at different times over the years and find him to be very, very much his own man, a very independent thinking person. And my feeling is, and I'm just a lay person in this regard, but my feeling is that he's going to leave a mark on the court.
You know, I think that a lot of people who would have strongly opposed him had he been white were less comfortable opposing him because he was black, and they would really like to see a black Supreme Court justice. They would also like to see somebody in there who was perceived as more liberal than he is. Do you think that race should have been an issue in this, and what ways do you think it has been?
No, I mean, I think that that's a little, I mean, that's, you know, that's wishful thinking. I mean, we have a Republican president and, a conservative president. Obviously, he's going to appoint somebody who's conservative. So to then say, well, I wish he was liberal, it seems to me to be wishful thinking. I don't think race really has much to do with that.
You have often been referred to as a black neoconservative. Do you think that that's an accurate label insofar as any label is ever accurate?
No, I resent it. I don't think of myself as a neoconservative. I think I probably support 90% of what would be considered a liberal agenda on race. The problem is, if you ever mention the principle of self-reliance in regard to black problems, you are automatically a conservative. You can support social programs all day long, but if you mention self-help or self-reliance, then you are blaming the victim, you are against blacks, and you are a conservative. So that's the litmus test. That's where that label comes from. And again, it has more to do, I think, with the limited terms by which we discuss race in America than anything to do with me.
I've heard some people criticize you for having moved to a white suburb and who have interpreted that as a kind of abandoning of black culture and black people. What's your response to that? What kind of pressures, what kind of like group pressures do you feel are put on successful blacks like yourself that you think are unfair?
Well, that's unfair. I mean, in every way, the middle class of any race tries to get into a neighborhood where the schools are at least halfway decent, where their property values are reasonable, and so forth. This is absolutely inevitable. It's necessary. The problem that I say, and many of my friends in situations like me, is that why in the heck aren't you coming to join me here? You can't expect people in life to move backward. We move forward. We move up. No one wants to take their children and put them in an environment where there's violence and there's drugs. And what would that gain? On the other hand, what I think those people also need to understand, because often the accusation is that, well, if you live, if you're not living in the black community, then you're isolated. Quite the opposite. I was called a nigger 2 weeks ago in a parking lot. That's the kind of, because it is precisely because I am in the larger community that I probably run into 10 times more racism than anybody who lives in the ghetto runs into. So my black experience in the sense of victimization never leaves me, never will.
And you don't mean that in the sense to play up your role as victim, right?
No, and I don't want to wade around in my victimization. No, because I have to keep going, whether he calls me a nigger or not, don't I? I've got to live life. And I'll be damned if I'm going to let him make that into an identity for me. The problem is really his.
Well, Shelby Steele, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Shelby Steele is the author of The Content of Our Character, A New Vision of Race in America. It's just come out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.